I'm Sian Pryor and welcome to Blueprint for Living, your weekly guide to the good life. And today on Blueprint for Living, we're going to give you a series of warm inner glows. We'll talk about animal tourism, whether it's visiting the animals we love or taking them with us on our travels, and yes, even hunting animals as a tourist activity. What makes humans want to cross borders to see critters? We'll tell you the best way to go about keeping chooks in your backyard, including which breeds will lay the most eggs for you. And I'll be ducking into a new restaurant where the warm inner glow comes from the spicy ingredients in Chinese cuisine. I had a chance to taste Chef Victor Leong's famous eggplant dish and my eyes are still watering.
I grew up eating a lot of Chinese food, so a lot of that flavour base here in the restaurants is from like flavour memories and meals that I've had growing up. So we're just trying to change that up a little bit and make it more my style and less my mum's style.
Victor Leong, the owner of a new Chinese restaurant called Li Ho Fuk. That's coming up soon here on Blueprint for Living. Now, if you're living in a big city, you might have noticed in recent years that the cold, harsh concrete of the city is slowly being taken over by pockets of green, where people are growing and eating their own food. Urbanites, it seems, are clamouring for a taste and a feel of the rural. Broadcaster turned food and garden writer Indira Naidu has gone looking for places where this is happening. In her book, The Edible City, she showcases five urban pockets across the country where people have transformed their small patch of the city into a life-growing oasis. Indira, welcome to Blueprint for Living.
Thank you, Sian.
Now, in your book, you talk about a momentous change taking place across the country. What have you been noticing?
Well, I think it's a movement that is happening quietly but decisively. I think that that's why it's not so obvious to people who are not part of the movement. But when you just duck around behind a church or you go behind a school or you nip up onto a rooftop, suddenly you see that instead of tarmac and concrete and tin roofs, we're starting to see green things growing, trees, vegetable gardens, beehives, even some chook runs as well, in places you just wouldn't expect in the heart of the city. And everyone's getting involved. The cross-section of socioeconomic groups that are involved in it has been quite surprising. And I've documented in the book that it's as wide-ranging as a homeless group in the inner city of Sydney that have built a rooftop garden on their roof. A lovely school, in inner city Sydney, of Indigenous kids have dug up part of their asphalt and put a bush tucker garden there. A group of migrants and refugees have built a beautiful community garden in Melbourne. And then retirees next to a nursing home have put in a garden, dug up a park, and that's become a wonderful area for social engagement and social interaction. And I think that's the part of it that I found really exciting.
The communal part.
That's right. It's not only about the growing of the vegetables. It's that sense of community. It's meeting your neighbours. It's doing something together that's different from your office work and the other jobs that take up so much of our time.
And is that what makes it different from, I mean, in some ways, you know, everything old is new again. A couple of generations ago, when this was not such an incredibly wealthy country, people were doing this by necessity, weren't they? People were growing veggies in their backyard to feed themselves.
Absolutely. Most of the houses that we lived in the 50s and 60s had backyards with veggie patches. It was a very common sight. Everyone had a lemon tree in their backyard. But what's happened really in the last two generations is that we're finding our houses have got bigger, so they've gone right to the fence lines. There's no room to grow food in our backyards anymore. Or we've downsized or moved into apartments. Australia's a really urbanised city. 75% of people live in cities. There really isn't that area next to your house or in your house to grow, which is why people are deciding, well, that's not going to stop us growing food. We're going to reimagine these urban spaces, dig up, the car park, look at that balcony as a beautiful vertical vegetable garden, reimagining their spaces. So that's been really exciting as well.
So tell me about what you saw in relation to all of this at Sydney's Wayside Chapel.
The Wayside Chapel is particularly close to my heart because I live in the King's Cross Potts Point area. So I'd heard about the amazing work that the chapel does looking after homeless people in the area, people suffering with drug and alcohol abuse and mental health issues as well. But as a resident, it had only been this place where I'd seen ambulances or police cars racing towards it. So it had always been a place where you knew a lot of good was happening, but I hadn't been directly connected with it. And when they built a new extension at the Wayside Chapel, they asked me, following my first book, The Edible Balcony, where they'd seen that I was a gardener and I'd knew a little bit about how to grow in these small inner city areas, if I could come on board as an ambassador and help them run this vegetable garden. And the challenge was going to be, not only were we going to be on a rooftop, that's where they built their vegetable garden, but all our gardeners were going to be either homeless or suffering some of these really, you know, difficult personal issues. So we started gardening classes every Thursday afternoon, and we found that having a green space in that urban, gritty, grey, hard part of the city just so helped the people that were, you know, were coming and doing gardening.
In what ways?
I guess in horticultural therapy ways, really, just being around a green space, smelling, you know, having all that wonderful oxygen around you, smelling all the scents and aromas that come from fresh produce and plants, being able to touch it. We have Pee Wee, one of our regular gardeners, who just comes in every garden class and the first thing he does is hug the curry bush plant. And there's a beautiful photo in the book of him hugging the plant, and you could see that there's this wonderful transference of energy. And I think the plant enjoys it too, that they get. So it's not just the eating of these wonderful vegetables. It's that connection with each other. It's doing something productive. It's learning skills. They're learning about nutrition. We've got a cooking class now attached to the garden as well. And we've just recently put in 4 beehives, which are producing honey. And most recently, we were very excited, the celebrated chef Kylie Kwong has moved her restaurant just near the Wayside Chapel, and she asked us if we could supply honey for her restaurant menu. So she now uses Wayside Chapel honey in her beautiful pork buns. So really recommend if anyone goes to a restaurant to order those buns. And that's been really exciting for our gardeners because they're being recognised by a wonderful chef. The money that she gives the Wayside for that honey is then put back into our cooking and growing program. So it's been a wonderful social enterprise as well.
Yeah, and it's the feeling of productivity, isn't it? I mean, and it's become such a sort of ugly, overused word, hasn't it, productivity? But to feel productive in the original sense of the word, you know, whether it's producing food for someone else to sell in their restaurant or just producing food for yourself, it does something to a person, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It empowers you, definitely. And to see so much of our culture has started to tell us things like, well, if, you know, you can't really cook, you know, you're not a master chef, you should go to a restaurant, a proper chef, or someone pre-making your meals because you don't have time to cook. You know, cooking is hard. It takes a lot of time. And then let alone growing, you know, my gosh, don't even go there. I mean, that's going to be even more demanding. So we believe these messages without realising just 100 years ago, nearly everyone in Australia grew and cooked their own food. No one did it for us.
And these days, they're, on the other hand, there's a generation of people who probably have no idea where food comes from. One of the places you feature in the book is Mount Carmel School in Sydney, and you met a student there who made a big impression on you, didn't he?
There was a lovely student in the group who told me when he first joined Garden Club, he was 6 years old, he couldn't remember of ever eaten a fresh piece of fruit or vegetable before the vegetables he'd had in the garden club, because his parents came from a poor background. They lived in a food desert. There weren't really good supermarkets or fresh green grocers there. And everything
they had. Food desert, that's a thing.
Yes, that is. Yes, it's unfortunately a big trend amongst particularly, isolated, socio-disadvantaged urban areas. Mm. There's lots of these food deserts where people, even if they wanted to access food, there really aren't these places. And this lovely little boy had only remembered eating takeaway or frozen pizzas that he'd heated up in the microwave. So the first fresh thing he remembers was a pumpkin that grew in the garden at his school, and watching that grow from this tiny seed, just completely disbelieving that a pumpkin could come from something so
very
microscopic.
A very satisfying vegetable,
and then
a pumpkin.
Exactly. And then to see it in its large form and then make a pumpkin soup out of it, it completely transformed his life. And he's changed the culture of his family. He insists now that they do go out of their way to find fresh food and vegetables, and he's teaching his parents how to prepare some of these things he's learning in school.
Well, that leads me on to my next question, which was, how widespread is this trend, or is it really just confined to the affluent inner city suburbs?
At this stage, it's quite interesting. There are a registry of about 600 community gardens and city gardens across Australia. And while, yes, most of them are in the affluent areas of inner city Melbourne and inner city Sydney, the trend that's really fascinating for me is that they're popping up in areas that are experiencing real serious food security issues. So we're finding in our regional and some of our more remote communities in the Northern Territory, in Western Australia and Queensland, they're putting in food gardens in their communities because they don't have access to fresh food, or the food that they get is too expensive for them to afford. So there is a variety of different groups that are putting in food gardens. So it's not just one particular demographic that understands the importance of reconnecting to your food, being involved in how it grows, knowing what goes into it. I mean, that's another driver. People are really concerned about the chemicals now in their food, and a lot of the movement is to grow food that you know is going to be organic and doesn't have these harmful pesticides. Mm. So it's happening across the board.
So just briefly, there are 40 recipes in the book. Presumably these are recipes you can make from the things you can grow in your garden or your community garden?
Yeah, so the recipes in the book were inspired by what I saw growing in these five gardens. So if I saw a, you know, fresh lettuces, you know, that's what I would devise a recipe around. There is a beautiful edible salad of flowers. Again, that's a new trend. A lot of people are understanding that there are lots of edible flowers that you can eat as well. And beautiful, you know, from the kids at the school, some lovely cheesecake brownies and rhubarb crumble muffins. There's some delicious things in there. So just because you're eating vegetables and eating healthily, you don't have to, you know, miss out on delicious tasting things as well. So hopefully that is going to inspire people as well.
Well, Indira, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Sian. It's been my pleasure.
Indira Naidoo's book, Edible City, is The Edible City, is out now through Penguin. And we'll put one of Indira's recipe, I think the one for kale prosciutto and blue cheese tart, up on the Blueprint for Living program page. You can find us via the RN homepage. In the next hour, we'll continue with this theme of greening local neighbourhoods when we visit a so-called Australian transition city, Newcastle. People there are changing the face of their town one street at a time. I'm Sian Pryor, and you're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN, Radio Australia and online. Up next, our Blueprint for Living guide for what to watch and what to read this weekend.
Blueprint Reviews.
Time to catch up on some of the best books and the must-see TV on the cultural radar this week. And with us is John Page from Pages and Pages Bookshop in Sydney. What have you brought in for us today, John?
Hashan, I've brought in Some Luck by Jane Smiley, which is the first book in her Last 100 Years trilogy, which the first book came out last year and I missed it. I've only just discovered it. Book 2, Early Warning, is already out and on the shelves, and Golden Age, which is the third one, is being published in October. The book begins in 1920 in Iowa and tells the story of the Langdons. Walter has recently returned home from the First World War, and he and his new wife, Rosanna, have settled on a remote farm to start their life and start their family. And we get to know the whole family through their ups and downs on the farm and through the birth of each of their children. And we follow each of their children as they kind of make their way in the world and witness how each member of the family deal with history's big moments that come along. So the Wall Street crash of the late 20s, the Depression in the 30s, then the Second World War. And the book ends with the beginnings of the Cold War in the 1950s. And we see all their triumphs, the tragedies that affect this family, how their lives are changed and how some of their lives continue to stay the same. And I just fell in love with this whole family and each branch of it. And I can't wait to read the next two books.
It sounds epic. Is it a very long book?
It is epic. It's a good kind of, you know, good chunky read, but she just loses you in the writing. The way she kind of eases you into this family that she creates just sucks you straight into the story, and you fall in love with each character in different ways. And the big historic events are so familiar to us, but they affect each character in a different way, some small way, some big way. and telling the story from these different perspectives, she really fleshes out the context of these big events that we know so well, showing how important those events were in people's lives, but also showing how unimportant and insignificant some of them were as well. And I think that's a really rare thing to be able to pull off, and pull off really well.
I haven't read her before, I confess, John.
I haven't either. She won the Pulitzer Prize for A Thousand Acres, which is now on my list to read. But this was my first Jane Smiley experience. And as I said, I can't wait to get stuck into the rest of this trilogy.
Lovely. Thank you so much for that. So the book is Some Luck by Jane Smiley. And for your TV fix, here's independent TV critic Debbie Enker. Debbie, what should we be watching?
Well, one of the things we should be watching, I think, is a regrettably underappreciated and not widely seen Australian drama series called Tangle, which is very appropriately named. It ran for 3 seasons only on pay TV in 2009, 2010 and 2012. And really, it's a bit like the third part of a trilogy that might have started with The Secret Life of Us and Love My Way, with The Secret Life of Us looking at 20-something. Love My Way looking at 30-somethings, and Tangle looking at 40-somethings and their teenage children. It's very much about families. Basically, three families who live in kind of leafy suburbs of Melbourne around the Yarra River. And the heart of the drama is two sisters played by Justine Clarke and Kat Stewart.
Oh, dream team.
Yeah, look, it's got a fantastic cast. The cast also features Matt Day, Ben Mendelsohn, Catherine McClements.
And they're all tried and tested and beloved TV actors.
Yeah, and charismatic. I mean, actors who, when they join an ensemble, really bring a strong note of their own individual performance to it. And really the catalyst is the return to Australia after years away in London of Kat Stewart's character called Nat, and she's the older sister of Justine Clarke's character, and she's essentially come back to try to renew relationships with her now 15-year-old son, who she basically left when he was a toddler. He was adopted by another family. He's now having his 15th birthday as the series begins, and she's come back, much to the consternation of all those around her, because they don't know what the implications. She's a bit of a wild card, and the inspiration for her character was Becky Sharp in Vanity Fair. She's ambitious, intent on getting ahead, not that concerned with collateral damage. So it's a great setup, and it's a beautifully written series.
So you mentioned some of those other very successful TV series. Is any of the same writing team involved that were involved in this,
yes,
this one?
Fiona Serres is one of the main writers in this, and she was involved in Love My Way, and it's the same producers, John Edwards and Imogen Banks. And it can very much be seen as a trilogy, but whereas the earlier parts of it got quite a lot of attention and wide audiences, Tangle, for some reason, didn't do as well. It's a real shame that more people haven't seen it, because it's beautifully written and it's just incredibly clever about the relationship between parents and children and within generations. I mean, Matt Day, who was in it, described it as people trying to do the best that they can with their lives and really making a mess of it.
So it's for the 40-something generation, but is it still going to appeal to the 20s or the 60-somethings?
I think so, and I think teenagers who see it will also find the characters and the conflicts they face and the traumas and the decisions to be extremely appropriate to their lives. The characters are just really well written. There's a lot of truth and authenticity to their situations.
So that's Tangle, available on video on demand and DVD. Thanks, Debbie Enker. Still to come here on Blueprint for Living, we'll be talking animal tourism, and we'll get some tips on how to deal with some of the pesky problems that come with keeping chooks in a suburban backyard. I'm Sian Pryor. This is Blueprint for Living.
15 years old, I'm already moving out of home, and I don't care who I'm dealing drugs to, because I was blinded. I wasn't the person that obviously I should have been.
On The Spirit of Things, two angry young men talk about their descent into violence.
You know, I'd never really wanted to be a gang leader. It all came from, you know, like all the continued assaults that I had leading up to that, like 6 times a day.
Regrets, reflections and redemption. The Spirit of Things, Sunday evening at 6, here on RN.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand. walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fooks. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein.
Our next guest on Blueprint for Living is only 30 years old, so he wasn't actually born when Werewolves of London was topping the charts, but he's named his first restaurant after the lyrics of that song from the 70s. And Victor Leong is making a name for himself as a young gun chef who's pushing the boundaries of what we know about Chinese cuisine. After a few years gracing the streets of Collingwood, an inner suburb of Melbourne, his restaurant Lee Ho Fook has recently moved into the Melbourne CBD. So I went to visit Victor in his new premises in an old warehouse in Duckboard Place to find out about his background and to watch him in action in the kitchen.
So tell us about your family background. Where are your parents from?
My parents are from Malaysia and we migrated to Australia in 1991. So I did most of my schooling and my apprenticeship and all my cooking and stuff in Australia. So yeah.
And what sort of food did you grow up with?
I grew up eating a lot of Chinese food, so a lot of our flavour base here in the restaurant is from like flavour memories and meals that I've had growing up. Yeah, so we're just trying to change that up a little bit and make it more my style and less my mum's style, so yeah.
But what was your mum's style?
My mother was a very, very good home cook. She used to cook a lot of great, like, celebratory-style Chinese dishes, like a lot of Cantonese cuisine, and still a lot of regional kind of influences.
So tell me about the difference between Malaysian Chinese cuisine, if there is much, and mainland Chinese cuisine.
Well, Malaysian Chinese cuisine tends to be a lot of, like, wok dishes, like lots of vibrant flavours, quite heavy seasonings because portions are small, because the climate there is quite hot, so you don't really want to be sitting down eating multi-courses and stuff. But yeah, all still very delicious. And the mainland Chinese are very kind of regional. There's quite a lot of ingredients that are region-specific and cooking styles that are very region-specific. Like, for example, down south in, like, the Canton region, seafood plays a massive part. Steaming as a cooking style plays a massive part. But then up north, it's more like a wheat-based cuisine, so steamed breads, noodles, less kind of rice based cooking, a lot of kind of braising, even some dishes braised like in an oven, which is quite unusual in Chinese cuisine.
So have you drawn your menu from all of those different sources?
Yeah, so what we do is we research a lot of dishes that are quite traditional and try to take the flavour profile and the technique and yeah, produce something a little bit different and a little bit more interesting and sometimes a little bit more approachable, because, you know, there's some regional classics that are like, you know, rabbit's heads and a lot of offal dishes, but I kind of like the flavour profile or the technique or the sauce behind it. So what we're trying to extract from that is the essence of it, but to apply it to something that, you know, wouldn't usually be in Chinese food.
So tell me about the dish that you're going to prepare for us today. This is Lee Ho Fook's crispy eggplant with spiced red vinegar. Is this a traditional dish or one that you've created?
So this dish, I tested it when I was in Mr. Wong's, when I was a sous chef there, and with great success, and we've tweaked it a little bit to make it a Lee Ho Fook signature. It's been with us since we've opened. You know, a lot of people, they love it, you know. I've cooked so many of these that it's probably like, it's like my first child, you know. I'm just glad he's doing well.
Well, let me meet your first child. Let's go into the kitchen and I can watch you at work. So we're going to be working around people who are actually in this crowded kitchen making lunch for people who are upstairs, so I hope we don't get in their way. But obviously we start with the eggplant, which is cut how?
So the eggplant's cut into strips. This is a version of a quite traditional dish. So the dish is based off a fish fragrant eggplant, which is like a Szechuan classic. So it's got, you know, like sweet, sour, savoury flavours, and then layered on top of that is like a spice from the chilli, warmth from the Szechuan peppercorns, and a depth of flavour from garlic, chilli, and a fermented bean paste. So what we've done is we've cut the eggplant into fingers so it's easy to eat, and we've made a batter with rice flour and tapioca starch. So what's good about that is A, it creates a really light and crispy batter, and B, it's gluten-free. So
yay, because I'm one of those.
That's right. So it's always a winner. You know, you can't have a signature dish that only half the people in Melbourne can have. So
you're dipping it in the batter and dropping it into hot oil.
Yeah, that's right. So we just fry it. So it's got this really light, bubbly, crispy exterior. And the sauce is a certain ratio of sugars. So when we coat it in the sauce of caramelized red vinegar, what happens is because the water content is so low that the batter doesn't get a chance to get soggy.
They look like big chips.
Yeah, that's the idea. So, very simple dish, but, you know, I've thought about this a long time to get the ratios right. You know, the batter to be the way it is, the amount of eggplant to have, and, you know, the garnishes and so forth. So, yeah. So, this just gets fried until it's super crispy, and then it's just rolled in the sauce, and then garnished quite simply with sliced spring onions, sliced coriander stems, and a sesame salt.
Just starting to brown up now.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, you're just cooking it until it just kind of slightly caramelizes. You know, it won't really because the batter will protect the sticks, but eggplant becomes almost nice and sweet when you cook it to that point. You know, it goes from just soft to something a little, like, nutty, a little bit caramelized, and I really like eggplant. It's one of my favorite vegetables, so...
Is it one of those dishes that people will order and then order another one?
Yeah, most definitely. I think the most... most orders from one table was four, so this table of three ordered one, and then they ordered two, and then they had dinner, and then they ordered another one. So
then they took some home, did they?
Yeah, no. So yeah, as you can see, it's very crunchy. So we're just rolling this in a sweet sticky sauce.
So it's just getting totally coated in this delicious looking.
Yeah, just caramelized red vinegar with yeah, just some Szechuan peppercorns, chili garlic, and a mix of red and Chinese black vinegar. So we're just garnishing it with sliced spring onions, and the idea is you want to cover it so that every stick gets a little bit of the garnish because it adds something to the dish, you know. So the spring onions will add a nice freshness. Coriander will give it, like, quite earthy, herbal flavour. And it's just the stem, so it's quite nice and strong. And you don't need too much of it. And then we're just seasoning it the rest with the sesame salt, so it's just to get a, you know, another depth of flavour that's quite prevalent in that region. So that's the Liho Fook crispy eggplant.
Oh, it looks delicious. And you know what? I think I'm going to have to break my rules. You know, I'm one of those people who is fructose intolerant, so I really shouldn't be eating a lot of that. But
Victor,
I think I'm just going to have a tiny nibble of one bit. It's not going to burn my mouth, is it? Oh. Oh, dear. Yeah, no, I think I'll stop while I'm ahead. That is absolutely delicious. Wipe my fingers. Well, we might just exit the kitchen and leave people to do their work, and because it's a busy, busy day here. So, Victor, I cannot resist. I have to ask, have you had any werewolves visiting the restaurant yet?
Oh, you know what? This used to be Squizzy Taylor's Warehouse, so I wouldn't put it past the history of this building. You know, we've only been here 5-6 weeks, so we're yet to know if it's haunted yet, so...
Well, Victor Leong, it's been a great pleasure talking to you about your vision for Chinese cuisine. And just because we can, let's listen to a little bit more of Werewolves of London. I'm Sian Pryor, and this is Blueprint for Living.
Doing the Werewolves of London. I saw werewolves drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's. His hair was perfect.
I think my tonsils are still recovering from the chili on that eggplant. Well, from werewolves to real-life animals now, we're talking animal tourism.
He was the most famous feline in all of Zimbabwe. Cecil the lion would lure tourists from around the world. But Cecil was killed earlier this month after hunters used an animal carcass as a lure.
My name is Dr. Walt Palmer. I started River Bluff Dental 17 years ago.
The accused poacher, an American dentist with a love of trophy hunting. He's issued a statement saying, I had no idea that the lion I took was a known local favourite.
That was from a news report that I'm sure most of you heard about the killing of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe a few months ago by an American dentist on a hunting holiday. The worldwide condemnation was swift and fierce, but this awful episode raises some interesting questions about why certain animals provoke such strong reactions and how we think about and interact with animals when we're being tourists. Kevin Markwell is an associate professor at the School of Business and Tourism at Southern Cross University, and he recently edited a book called Animals and Tourism, Understanding Diverse Relationships. And he joins us now from our Lismore studio to unpack the ethics of tourism and those complicated relationships that we have with animals. Welcome to Blueprint for Living, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Sian.
Now, I guess you could call the killing of Cecil the Lion an example of kill tourism. I suspect that's not a technical term. But tell us about some of the less horrible ways in which animals are involved in tourism.
Well, if I can just start with Cecil for just a minute. I think Cecil highlights the ambiguities and inconsistencies that characterise our relationships with animals, and that's fascinated me for many years. And I think tourism is an ideal domain, if you like, to explore those in more detail. In the case of Cecil, he's the end result of hunting tourism. Hunting tourism is an important component of many destinations, but it involves ultimately the death of living animals. And I think when those animals are photographed in poses where the hunters are clearly proud of themselves, and often there's a lack of respect for those animals implicit in those photos, and then they end up in someone's Facebook feed, people react very, very strongly to that. But many of those people who reacted so strongly, I suspect, went home and ate some kind of animal for dinner that night. So we are, you know, our relationships are so complex and ambiguous and inconsistent in many ways. And tourism, as I said, is a fantastic vehicle to explore those. Animals have been used as tourist attractions for centuries in all kinds of ways. They're still a very important driver for tourism at many destinations. We imagine when we're travelling that we'll encounter all kinds of strange and unusual animals, or that we'll somehow get close to those animals. And tourism provides opportunities for getting close in some way to animals, which we ordinarily wouldn't.
Yeah, so it's not all as brutal as what happened to Cecil the Lion. You know, I, for example, vividly remember being so excited about visiting Mission Beach in Queensland, mm-hmm. and getting to see a cassowary live out in the bush.
Mm. And when you have that experience, for many people, that can be quite a profound experience that stays with them for maybe the rest of their lives, or certainly for a long time. And people draw on that experience, and from a conservation perspective, we hope that positive experience will mean that people are more interested in this case the cassowary, and be concerned about its future, and maybe actively participate in some way to donate money or something, or write to a politician to say, hey, look, cassowaries are an endangered species, they're having a hard time, we really need to do something to protect them.
So in some ways, our love of animals and our animal tourism can turn the fortunes around, can't it? Whale watching, for example.
Certainly. Whales are a great example where, up until literally a few decades in Australia and other countries, they were seen as a resource to be killed, hunted, and then converted into a variety of products. Once whales were protected, they have become, they're still an economically important a resource, if you like, but that resource is a living one that remains alive. The whale watch industry provides opportunities for people to go and have a reasonably close encounter with whales. It's, when people see whales out in the ocean, it's a wonderful experience. They're a majestic animal, and that seeing them in real life can have a significant impact on people and their empathy and respect for those animals.
But Kevin, even when we're engaged in what you could see as sort of pro-animal tourism, sometimes we love them too much, don't we? I mean, people who get too close to whales on whale-watching trips.
Absolutely. And often we don't realise we're loving them too much either. So there's a lot of ignorance in how we interact with animals. And sometimes, you know, the science still isn't very clear either. There's research going on now which suggests that some species of whales in some locations respond to the arrival of a whale-watching vessel in the same way that they were trying to avoid a predator. So they actually go into a kind of a predator avoidance behaviour and might sink lower or swim away or whatever else they might do. In other examples of research, some people have been looking at the interaction between tourists and monkeys in certain locations, and the behaviour of monkeys is such that if this particular monkey scratches itself quite a lot, then that's an indication that it's stressed in some way. They also do an analysis of their droppings to measure the quantity of stress hormone in their droppings, and they compare monkeys that have interaction or observed by tourists with monkeys who don't have any tourist interaction at all. And they do find that, in fact, behaviourally, those monkeys seem to be more stressed, and when tourists get very, very close and throw food at them, etc., their level of stress hormones increases as well. So there are ways around that, of course, and so by reducing the proximity between tourists and the animals and educating tourists so that they behave in ways that actually don't stress the animals. But of course, in many primates, looking face to face and looking and maintaining eye contact, which is of course what tourists want to do, they want to see an animal looking back at them, that actually causes stress to primates.
Well, and you can see, you know, a really nasty example of this kind of stress in some zoo animals when you see those kind of stereotypy behaviours,
That's right.
Animals walking up and down and up and down the perimeter of their cage.
Absolutely. And certainly there's been, you know, radical redesign of animal enclosures over the last few years, and we talk about immersive exhibits and exhibits which are very naturalistic and, you know, the many species of animals seem to exist quite well in captivity today. But there are still certain species, and in my book, some authors from the States who had worked at SeaWorld in Florida give quite a graphic account of what they see to be inherent cruelty in keeping an animal that is so large and which is so social in very, very small enclosures. And so there's a whole raft of problems that those animals experience in terms of getting sunburn, in terms of even getting mosquito bitten, which by and large the average visitor to a facility like that isn't aware of. So, you know, as long as the animal looks like it's been cared for, and then most visitors are quite happy to go along. And again, another chapter in the book looks at the plight of elephants in Thailand, and people can go and watch elephants, you know, performing all kinds of un-elephant-like things, like throwing darts at balloons and standing on their two legs or whatever it is. And visitors don't realise that in order to get an animal like an elephant to be so compliant, there's an awful lot of what we would regard as cruelty to enforced on that elephant.
And people do love an elephant, right? Kevin Markwell, we also sometimes will eat different kinds of animals when we're on holidays to what we would normally eat in our daily lives, weren't we?
That's right. One of the characteristics of our experience of going away and leaving our homes is that we often leave our normal conventions that kind of guide us on our day-to-day basis, and we'll do things which we wouldn't ordinarily do, or we might drink a little bit more, or we might take risks, and of course adventure tourism is predicated on that desire to do things out of the ordinary. And part of that for some people is to enjoy the local food in some way. And you know, provided that the animals that are being eaten are hunted in an ethical and sustainable way, you know, there's really not much that you can argue against that
unless you
have a philosophical view of not eating animals.
Yeah.
But yeah, we usually don't have any indication whether the animals, you know, whether the chicken's been farmed in a free-range situation or whether the animal itself itself may be even locally endangered. And a great example of that was, I was in Vanuatu a few weeks ago, and there's a very large crab called the coconut crab, which unfortunately for it happens to be quite delicious, and it's been subjected to hunting pressure for quite some time, to the extent that it's now quite endangered. And so those crabs shouldn't really be eaten anymore, but there's still a demand that the tourists are creating for that crab on restaurant menus. And so I saw a number of restaurants that were advertising, yes, we sell coconut crab here. So another example, I guess, people who go to Cambodia or Vietnam, they might see snake wine and see that as, you know, part of the local culture. And, well, you know, if you're, you know, it's a must-do experience if you're in Vietnam, you must try the snake wine. And whilst, you know, tourists will be told that, well, the snakes come from snake farms, and often that's enough for many tourists, those snake farms usually aren't actually breeding the snakes. The snakes are being hunted out of the wild and then just that reside in this holding facility for a while until they're killed. And so now the populations of rats in some rural areas are increasing because the number of snakes that should be eating them are gone. And so that tourist market is actually increasing the demand for something which might be locally authentic and part of the culture, but when you get, you know, large numbers of tourists who are now also wanting to partake in that, then there's going to be a problem with the local species.
So briefly, Kevin, I suppose the question here is what responsibility individual tourists have when it comes to, I guess, interacting ethically with animals on their holidays.
And that issue of ethics is a strong theme throughout my book. So what is, you know, how should we treat animals in the context of tourism? What is the best, most ethical way? And individual tourists can do some research. There's some great non-government organisations that have fantastic websites like Right Tourism, and it actually provides a lot of information about what you should and shouldn't do as a tourist in relation to animals. There's, you know, many people will encounter so-called photo prop animals when they're travelling, where someone...
So the main message is do your research before
that's right.
you go.
Yep. And we have access to that information now through the net.
Great. Look, thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you, Sian.
Kevin Markwell is from the School of Business and Tourism at Southern Cross University, and his book is called Animals and Tourism, Understanding Diverse Relationships. And look, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You can comment on this and any other story on our website and also on our Facebook page. So do join in the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Up next, how to best care for your backyard chooks. Well, it's becoming more and more popular for city dwellers to keep chickens in their backyards. Blueprint producer Maria Tickle, for example, has joined the ranks of enthusiastic new chook owners. And to get some tips on what to do and what not to do to keep her girls healthy and happy, Maria's been chatting to Jessamy Miller. Jessamy was the poultry consultant on a new book, Happy Hens. Maria, over to you.
Thanks, Sian. Jessamy, I have two Isa Browns, and they're good layers and they're pretty easy to keep. But what are some of the other breeds that people should consider? Some of the more exotic breeds, perhaps?
Well, I love pure breeds because they've got a long history and they've got great personalities and they've got particular qualities like longevity. They might lay for many years longer than an Isa Brown. And the ones I really recommend for laying would be a Black Langshan and an Ancona, two beautiful breeds.
What do they look like?
The Ancona is black with white spots, very pretty, floppy red comb. And the Langshan is a very smooth feathered chook with feathered legs and big glossy liquid black eyes.
And are they good layers as well? Because that's why I've had Isa Browns, because they're notoriously
they
good
are
layers.
Great layers. But these are the top purebred layers. If you get the right strain, they're terrific and I heartily recommend them. And they make lovely pets as well.
So they're good with kids?
They're terrific with kids, but they wouldn't be my first choice just as a pet.
Mm-hmm. And if what, I was, what would be?
Well, looking for a pet, I would choose a silky, because what's not to love about those adorable top-knotted...
They're the little ones with the little tuft on the top of their head and the furry feet.
Yes, they're fluffy.
Cute ones.
Children adore them and they're so docile and just very entertaining. And of course, your Pekin Bantam is a lovely, placid, great mother, very gentle chook to have around children.
But they're not particularly good layers. So if you want omelettes out of your chooks, they're not really the ones to get, are they?
No, they aren't. They're the sort of chooks that will lay a clutch of eggs and then go broody. So they're great mums if you want to breed chickens, great pets, but go to your Langshan and your Ancona if you just want those eggs.
Now, with pet chooks, the upside is the eggs, as you mentioned, but there's also the downside. Why do chooks love to poop on concrete so much? I mean, my paths are like chicken poop magnets.
Look, I'm not sure either. All I know is the back doorstep is the number one spot at our place for a little deposit. And the time that they dropped one in my husband's croc shoe was not a happy day. Look, I guess they just drop them where they need to, and perhaps a little hose down or a squish with the rake will deal with that problem.
No, I reckon they've got a strategy. I'm not sure what it is, but they have one. And with the chicken poop comes flies, especially in summer. I've been using those fly traps with the smelly stuff inside, but they're pretty awful themselves. What else can you do to deal with the flies?
You can actually buy natural fly papers online. So I use those. I hang them from the roof out of reach of the chooks so they'll catch flies. You can make your own fly traps out of a drink bottle, cut in half, turn the top over, put some stale milk or a little bit of meat in there, and the flies will creep in and can't get out. But the main thing to do is just keep really good hygiene in the hen house. Move that poo on into the compost bin when you see it. Perhaps do a big clean up each weekend and just keep it really nice and not too damp in there.
And just some other things that can go wrong. Weak shells. If your chicken is laying shells that are really weak and transparent, what can you do? Is that a lack of something?
Absolutely. So your shells are 95% calcium carbonate, and that sounds like you need more shell grit. So chooks actually know how much shell grit they need. All they need to be given is a bowl full of shell grit. It's super cheap at the pet food store. Buy a bag, fill up that bowl, and they can help themselves when they need it.
What about I've sort of mortar and pestled eggshells themselves to feed back to the chooks. Is that a good idea or not?
That's a great idea. Absolutely, go for it. And that means you'll probably use less shell grit and it's a bit more efficient, but you still need to give the shell grit as well because the eggshells just might not be enough. And actually, if chooks don't get enough calcium, they leach it out of their bones to make their eggs. So we never want that to happen.
And one thing that happens in winter is often my chickens go off the lay. Is that normal and why do they do that? And what can I do to stop it so I can keep getting those eggs?
Look, it's absolutely normal. Chooks need a break, like all of us, a little holiday. So after their second year of laying, they'll have their autumn molt and then they take the winter off. And once they get enough daylight to stimulate their laying hormones, which is around 14 hours, they start production again. So if you want to have eggs all through winter, you need to sequentially plan the members of your flock. So if you bought a pullet that was coming in to lay in autumn, she will lay all through winter for you in her first year and then not take a break until the following winter. But actually, just to keep an older bird 2 or 3 or 4 years old laying through winter, you would probably have to give artificial lighting, which is quite a complex method. So I actually like to let them have that natural rest and just keep a few pullets for the eggs.
What about feather pecking?
Look, this is a common problem, especially with your Isa Brown type birds. And often it can be because they really want the protein in the feathers. So the first thing to do is make sure they're getting lots of protein in their daily ration. So pellets, mixed grain or mash with at least 16% protein, and not too many treats or scraps is really important. Then you want to give them a distraction. So make sure they're not overcrowded or bored. Give them some outdoor time, maybe hang some greens up for them or give them a bale of straw to play with and keep them busy and focus the pecking on that. If it does get really bad and one chook's being bullied, you might want to take her out, give her a break, let her heal before putting her back in.
What about worming? What do you do? Do you give them, like with cats, do you give them medicine or...?
Well, chooks shouldn't need a proprietary wormer as often as cats or dogs do. So what I like to do with my chooks is once a month at the full moon, not for any esoteric reason, but just to keep track
you howl
of the date.
And then you worm your chooks.
I haven't tried the howling, but you never know. I pop garlic in their water for 3 days to treat their intestines, and that should make it an unpleasant place for worms to settle in. I use a quarter of a clove of garlic per bird per day, and that seems to work really well. So it would only be if your bird was quite unthrifty, losing weight, not interested in eating, clearly unwell, that you would need to then go to the vet and get a proprietary wormer.
So this is a difficult question. What do you do with them when they're finished laying?
Well, this is sort of your end-of-life plan, and it's actually a good idea to think about this before you get into chooks, because your chook may have 2 or 3 years of eating after she stops laying regular eggs if she's well and healthy. So you have to decide, has she done good service by you? Do you want to give her a pleasant old age? You could maybe say, well, what does the cat or dog give me really? And I'm happy to fund them. Or you could say, I'm not up for this. I'm going to perhaps dispatch her and pop her in the compost.
And how do I do that?
Well, if you're not confident, get someone who is to do it, because we really want to dispatch a chook humanely and without any stress or fuss. That's very important. I find the easiest way is to lay a chook down gently. She's calm, and just chop off her head.
You do that yourself?
I do that myself, because I've raised my own meat chickens, so I had to learn how to do it.
Was that really hard the first time you did that? I couldn't do it.
Look, I wasn't sure if I could do it, but I felt that I needed to have that skill to be an all-round poultry keeper. And I think if you're in the headspace and you've prepared yourself, you've named these meat chicks pot roast, they know what they're for, they've had a lovely life, and look, if you're going to eat meat anyway, it's good to have your own humane home-reared meat.
Jessamy Miller, Chook Whisperer. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
And if you want to know more about keeping chooks and to read some of Jessamy's articles, ABC Books has put out a collection of articles from Organic Gardener. It's called Happy Hens.
Headless chooks. There you have it. Blueprint's Maria Tickle there. And if you have a vexing poultry keeping problem, hop on to the Blueprint for Living Facebook page, because Jessamy will be there answering your chook questions this weekend. This is Blueprint for Living on RN Radio Australia and online. And now to one of Manhattan's most iconic buildings, here's Colin Bissett.
Squeezed into a triangular site in Midtown Manhattan, the Fuller Building, which was nicknamed the Flatiron Building because it resembled the domestic irons of the time, was designated an icon of New York as early as 1966. And yet, for all its fame, it's not really a New York building at all. It was designed in 1902 by Daniel Burnham, an architect from Chicago, where the first skyscrapers had been built. These had steel frames, which meant that the outer walls were not load-bearing and could therefore be filled with large windows. A particular style evolved based on the classical column, with a solid-looking base incorporating the lower floors, a taller shaft above with the main floors, and the whole thing finished off with an intricate cornice, just like a column's capital. The whole building was often faced in terracotta to mimic the richness of carved stone. In Chicago, Burnham and his partner John Root provided a shining example of the style with their celebrated Reliance Building of 1891, which still looks remarkably modern thanks to its large windows. So when New York changed its building regulations to allow Chicago-style skyscrapers, Burnham's Flatiron Building was among the first to go up. The base was finished in limestone, but the rest was faced in terracotta that was intricately ornamented with classical motifs. The whole thing was divided into distinctive bands of base, shaft and capital, a completely new style for New York. But it was the remarkable wedge shape that really caught everyone's attention, the way its 22 stories came to a 2-metre-wide point. One commentator remarked that it looked like a ship sailing down Fifth Avenue. Others thought its apparent narrowness would cause it to fall over in high winds. But its steel frame was immensely strong and quickly became the blueprint for much taller skyscrapers in New York. It did nothing to damage Burnham's reputation as a man of grand vision. He said, make no little plans, and he kept to his word, working on huge schemes for new cities in the Philippines as well as in America. In London, in 1909, he designed the Selfridge department store, giving it a monumental treatment with heavy columns along its facade. His company became the largest architectural firm in America until his death in 1912, and even architects who deplored his overblown designs spoke with respect about his passion. The Flatiron Building remains a favourite, and the area surrounding it was officially renamed the Flatiron District in the 1980s. Its Chicago style, after all, makes it the perfect symbol for Manhattan, an outsider embraced.
Colin Bissett there, paying homage to Manhattan's Flatiron Building. Stay with us on Blueprint for Living because in the next half hour we'll visit Newcastle, a town which is leading the way in a new social movement that I reckon you'll like. It's called the Transition Movement and it's changing the way local neighbourhoods look and feel.
The idea of our separateness is very new. It's a very new experiment in the world. Healthy neighbourhoods where people know each other, people actually live longer, is what the research tells us.
That's coming up next here on Blueprint for Living.
Si te acercas un poquito más, me meterás en ti.
I'm Sian Pryor and you're listening to Blueprint for Living. And it's time to grab your dancing shoes because we're heading to the Caribbean.
Nunca jamás así susurrándome.
Now, sometimes in our travels, there's one particular place that seeps into our soul and remains a source of inspiration and reflection long after we've returned home. For our next guest this morning, classical pianist Tamara Ann Chislovska, that place is a little island on the edge of the Bermuda Triangle, a place that enthralled her from the moment she landed on its shores, and it is Puerto Rico. Tamara, thanks for joining us on Blueprint for Living.
Thanks, Sian. Lovely to talk to you.
Now tell us, there's a bit of a story attached to this this song we were just listening to. A couple of Puerto Rico's most famous singers involved in that one.
That's right. One of them was Ricky Martin and the other was Robbie Draco Rosa, who people may not know actually wrote a lot of Ricky's songs and was with him early on in a boy band. And I had the pleasure of meeting Draco when I was in Puerto Rico. I didn't know I was meeting him at the time and was told later. And of course, I sheepishly had to admit that I'd never heard of him before. He took that very well.
He might never have heard of you either, Tamara.
Well, look, funnily enough, he hadn't. But we exchanged stories and we had breakfast together in the hotel that we were both staying at. And he was coming back to Puerto Rico to visit his property in the mountains, and I think he was starting a coffee plantation there. And he was absolutely delightful. He attended some rehearsals that I had. I was performing with members of the Puerto Rican Symphony, and Draco came along, and he spent half the time recording us on his little iPhone. And he was very interested, and we even mentioned collaboration, but that hasn't come about yet.
How exciting. Well, look, let's go back to the beginning. What took you to Puerto Rico last year? Was it for work or was it, I mean, clearly there was pleasure there, but was it originally for work or for pleasure?
There was lots of pleasure to be had there, but I went to perform. I'm a pianist, as you said, and my New York agent rang me early last year and said, oh, they want you down in Puerto Rico. Do you think that'd be something you'd be interested in? And I thought for about 2.5 seconds, and I said, oh, yes. I said, isn't there a new direct flight to Dallas that I can just hop on and then pop down to San Juan? And so she said they're interested in having you come and perform solo, but also the symphony orchestra would like to play with you as well. They'd like you to do some chamber music with them. I thought it sounded terrifically exciting. I'd been to America a number of times on tour, but very first time in the Caribbean for me, so I couldn't wait.
And what were your first impressions when you arrived?
Well, I flew to Dallas and then across to Miami, and then from there it's about a two-hour plane trip down to San Juan. And, of course, you're flying right through the Bermuda Triangle, and it was a night flight. And so I was swept up in the whole mystery and mystique of the Bermuda Triangle. And I had a few palpitations as well, just thinking, I kept looking out the window and listening to the wind and thinking, I know it's high hurricane season right now, but please, I don't need that much excitement. And then when I landed, I was met by the concertmaster of the Puerto Rican Symphony Orchestra, whose name is Henry Hutchinson. And
how very un-Puerto Rican sounding.
Yes. I think he has more names. Everyone has many names in Puerto Rico, and they only give you a couple.
But he is a local?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. And Henry Hutchinson Negron, I think, was part of his full name. And anyway, so he met me off the plane, and the first thing he did was to hand me this bug spray and say, now, before we leave the airport, you have to spray yourself all over with this, because we didn't mention it to you before, but we're in the middle of a chikungunya epidemic in Puerto Rico, and people have been getting very ill, and a couple of people have actually passed away. He told me this very casually. He said, and I just want you to keep this with you at all times and keep respraying. And I said, oh, well, hello, Henry, as well, you know, and thank you for that welcome. He said it in a delightful way.
It didn't make you want to jump back on the plane and go home again?
Well, I had some, gave me a little pause. It's actually quite a serious virus, this chikungunya, even though it sounds like a nice dinner out. And you get these terrible joint pains and horrible fevers.
Which is not what you need. You're making me not want to go to Puerto Rico. Tell me something about it that will make me want to go.
Well,
you stayed in a very beautiful hotel, I believe.
I stayed in the most beautiful boutique hotel in Old San Juan, which is the old part of the city. And I mean, it's the second oldest city anyway in the Americas. And it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, it was 400 years under Spanish rule. And so you have all this incredible Spanish colonial architecture, and there's an incredible Gothic cathedral there, which I think was constructed in about 1520, which is pretty amazing, you know, for an Australian girl going there, and things that are just hundreds of years old. You know, I think we have a particular awe for that history. And
yes.
It's incredibly beautiful. It's quite hard to describe in words how wonderful it is in Old San Juan. I mean, the streets are, you know, cobblestone, and each building will be a different colour. It's incredibly vibrant.
Now, look, maybe it's just because I know Puerto Rico through its music, but I reckon the nightlife would be pretty memorable. Tell us well, what it's like in San Juan.
Well, I was working most of the time, Sian, so I wasn't partying that much, but I met some fantastic people, and I had some wonderful dinners, especially with the lady who ran La Galleria, which was where I was staying. Her name is Jan De Sopo, and she's a really well-known artist. She came to Puerto Rico in, I think, the early 1960s, and an incredible woman, quite a character, always with a parrot on her shoulder. The Galleria is full of exotic birds, and you walk from room to room, and you hear this little hola, hola, and you turn around, and of course it's some kind of exotic Brazilian something, and they're quite incredible. She'd given them all artist names. One of them was called Picasso. There was Campeche, which is a Puerto Rican Rococo artist, and there was a Rembrandt, and you know, it's quite the world. I mean, yeah. I had that feeling. I was thinking, you know, Fantasy Island.
Yes.
I was thinking
Johnny Depp.
I was thinking, yeah, pirates and True Blood and all that kind of. It was incredibly evocative.
Speaking of pirates, I believe there are some myths and legends still about pirate treasure. Tell us about this. Mm.
Well, there is, and it's quite the industry where, you know, people, they actually come on treasure hunts to Puerto Rico, and there's lots of caves and mountains and beaches and many kind of areas where it's been rumoured that, you know, they had a famous pirate called Roberto Cofresi, I think was his name, and he was captured in the end. But before he was captured, I think he had claimed to have made 700 seizures of different ships and treasures.
How long ago are we talking? Like, how old?
We're talking about the beginning of the 19th century.
Okay.
So I think he was born in about the 1790s, and he died at a young age, as a lot of pirates did. I think he died at about 30.
He was a real-life pirate of the Caribbean.
He was a real-life, exactly, pirate of the Caribbean.
Now, you got out of San Juan, too, and went to the other side of Puerto Rico. What's the landscape like over there?
Well, I went over to Ponce to perform as well, and that's over on the other side. I mean, it's not very big island, really. I think it's less than 100 kilometres across, so it just took less than a couple of hours in the car. We drove through these incredible mountains, and you can imagine how green it is. And I didn't have any real expectations before going there, apart from thinking, you know, take your swimsuit, because I knew the weather was going to be pretty sultry.
So you went over to the other side and meet any interesting characters over there?
Oh, I met so many wonderful people. Apart from the musicians that I met a huge number, hundreds of people from the Musical Foundation, because they had this incredible garden party for me after one of the concerts. And it was something, I have never seen such a spread of incredible fresh seafood and wonderful tropical fruits, and you know, they'd made gumbos and sort of traditional Spanish dishes. It was quite amazing, and their hospitality was extraordinary.
Are they a superstitious people, Tamara?
They are, actually, yes, very much so. And I was sort of indoctrinated into one of their particular customs, which I have continued on for the entire year, and that is Gnocchi Night. They have something called Gnocchi Night, where on the 29th of each month, the idea is you have a gnocchi meal, because this is, you know, coming up to the end of the month, you're about to have your new payday, and so probably you don't have much left in the house to cook, but, you know, gnocchi is just potato and a bit of water and a bit of flour. So you make the gnocchi on the 29th, and you eat a gnocchi meal, and you take a coin or a dollar, and you keep it with you. So you put it either in your pocket or under your plate, and this brings you financial good fortune in the future. And so I started this. I happened to be there on the 29th of the month, and they very, very seriously told me about this, and we did it together. There was about four of us at La Galleria, and I just can't stop myself from doing it ever since. And I thought, well, I can't stop now. I've started. So
that's right. You never know when your ship's going to come in, when the money's going to start
Exactly.
flowing.
I've been a gnocchi girl ever since.
Oh, sounds gorgeous. Well, next time you go, I'm coming with you.
Oh, you can.
That's classical pianist Tamara Anna Chislovska talking about her attachment to the Caribbean island of Puerto Rico. Coming up, we're going to take a look at a new community movement that is changing local neighbourhoods one street at a time. And leading the pack here in Australia is the city of Newcastle. You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN, and I'm Sian Pryor. And it's time to speak to the lovely Anne Jones about what she's been up to this week. What do you have coming up on Off Track, Anne?
I have a bit of a surprise this week on Off Track, and that is a glimpse into the insides of Australian mammals.
Ew.
I know, sounds a bit odd, but it's actually with one of the senior vets at Taronga, who's just put out a book on the radiology of Australian mammals, and that means the bones, you know, and all of the bits and pieces that make up their shape. which is sort of interesting because if you think about, say, the platypus, for example, they're really, really odd. And I will answer the question, what is inside a platypi bill that is in the show?
Fantastic. I mean, we do see a lot of, you know, dead bones lying around of Australian mammals, don't we? But it sounds like this is a different approach.
It absolutely is. These animals are still alive when the images were taken, at least.
That sounds amazing. Thanks, Anne. And you can hear Off Track straight after Blueprint for Living today. Are people in your street neighbourly? Do you share stuff around? Well, you might even be candidates for a movement that's changing the world one street at a time. That's the grand plan for the transition movement. The idea of transition streets, where neighbours get together and decide how to live more sustainably, began in the UK in 2002, and it's gaining traction here in Australia, where there are now transition streets and even towns in every state. Newcastle was the first. Annie Hastwell went along to see how this bottom-up movement for social change is getting on, 7 years after its founders first started knocking on their neighbours' doors. Round and round, up and down, through the streets of your town. Every day I make my way through the streets of your town.
It's basically a vegetable garden, but we decided to put in a few flowers just to brighten it up and give it a bit more colourful to like make it stand out more, which I think is really good.
Alexa Stewart, her sister Jasmine and mother Kathy are showing me around this flourishing garden which sits right on the curb in Fitzroy Road in Newcastle.
We have awesome, really good broccoli that we've just gotten that was like really, really big. Yep.
And is the idea that other people can come and pick it?
Yeah.
We really do encourage people to come and pick stuff. Occasionally I'll find a few dollars in the letterbox and I know that someone must have picked something and and feel like they've got to contribute. They're very welcome to take it for free.
When Kathy and her family decided to turn their street into a transition street, they had to find out how many neighbours would be interested. Building this curbside garden was the icebreaker. They letterboxed the street to see who wanted to be involved.
We had no idea how many people would turn up, and when we saw people wandering down the street with their gardening gloves, it was just really exciting.
The next step was a little more daunting, sounding out neighbours to see if they were interested in coming to a meeting to discuss ways in which they could live more sustainably.
It's a bit of a scary thing, you know, to approach people, even if you know them, but probably more so strangers, and say, hey, I've come across this great program and it involves coming to neighbours' houses and getting to know each other and talking about these issues around sustainability. You know, that's a challenging thing.
The transition movement is designed as a bottom-up plan to save the planet. Neighbours get together to discuss the big issues of food, consumption, power and waste and what they can do. The movement's Bible is a workbook which guides discussion at these street get-togethers.
In some ways it is a little like a book club. You know, you read the chapter, you get together, you discuss it, you talk about what you want to do as a result of reading that chapter.
We did a couple of water challenges where we had to live off, I think it was one bucket of water per person for a whole day. That was quite hard.
What other kinds of things are you challenged by with transition streets?
Oh, there was another challenge where every time we opened the fridge, we had to put 5 cents in a jar to show how much electricity you were wasting every time you open the fridge, something that you don't even think about when you're doing it normally.
Just going for a bike ride, using bikes as transport, so going to the market, that's when we started probably riding to the market a lot more, and Alexa started riding to school as well. But yeah, just thinking about the bike differently from just being a recreational thing, that you use it as a mode of transport.
What I really like about transition movement is that it's about creating what we want rather than protesting about what we don't want.
Transition was originally inspired by the concept of peak oil and the growing realisation that the Earth's resources weren't infinite. Graham Stewart helped set up the first Australian streets here in Newcastle.
I guess we're concerned about climate change, resource depletion and skewed economy. So through transition movement, we're really interested in how can we create local economies that are low carbon, have less of an environmental impact.
Now, does anybody want a wine or a cup of tea?
At a very relaxed and neighbourly Sunday night dinner at Cathy and Graham's home in Fitzroy Road, I meet some of the other transitioners.
My name's Michelle. I live in this street, Fitzroy Road, and was invited along by my neighbours. I came along to meet the people in my street, and then I was also interested in sustainability. It's always in the back of my mind, but this brings it to the forefront and makes me more aware.
So what things have changed about how you live your life?
Well, I do have a garden in my backyard now, a vegetable patch. I try and not stay in the shower as long as what I used to stay in the shower. Try and think about what I buy when I go to the growers market. I try and buy what I only need so that I don't throw too many things away. Whereas before you go, oh, I might need that, I might need this, but you end up not needing it and throwing more things away. Whereas now I go back if I need more.
Knowing that other people are doing it as well makes it easier to do.
It does make it easier, thinking that you're not the only person. And having done this, it's nice to know everybody in your street. Like, I know a lot more people in my street now. And when I drive past, I like the fact that I wave to people that I never once knew and often stop off and say, do you have coriander or do you have mint? Or I haven't got any in my garden at the moment, and just grab things from other people's gardens. I love doing that.
Virginia Hanlon. This time I've lived here 7 years. I grew up in Newcastle and lived for many, many, many years.
But you're back and you're part of Transition Streets. Yes. Can you tell me what effect it's had on your life?
I think it made me realise how many people are very interested in sustainability, not just maybe my hippie friends. You know, a lot of people were actually already doing a lot and were very keen to learn a lot more, because you think you know a lot, but it's not till you actually read the workbook or with people who are very well informed that you learn a lot of other ways of being more sustainable. And
so what did you learn?
Well, now I have a really good garden at the back of my house, which was only concrete. So I'm growing things in the garden, and that's a challenge where I live, being on the ocean. And just I can call on the neighbours whenever I need anything. For all kinds of things, you know, who's got this? We share things in the street. I don't need a mower, but that kind of thing. And people did start sharing their things. We'd let one another know what we had, and so you don't all have to have it.
Once neighbours get into the swing of it, each transition street seems to find its own way. From communal solar power setups to car sharing clubs, and even in one case, the setting up of a community cinema. Here in Fitzroy Road, everyone liked the idea of getting more ethical about food. Cathy's found herself running a bulk organic food buying scheme, dubbed Transition Newcastle Pantry.
I have a massive spreadsheet. We have about $2,000 worth of food arriving on a big pallet in a truck, and it takes over one of our rooms in our house and the entrance, where we set up folding tables and unpack all the food. And then, you know, for example, we might have a 5 kilo bag of almonds, and out of that there'll be 6 or 7 people. Some people are getting 2 kilos, some people are getting 250 grams. A few of us get together on a day and work our way through this massive amount of food. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Fun and connection are the words that constantly come up. The transition movement worldwide is keen to show that it is making an environmental difference, and it does quite a bit of measuring of carbon emissions reduced, water saved, and household budgets slashed. But all the evaluations note that what people rate highest is the new sense of neighbourliness.
We have everything, but we're disconnected, and we watch reality on television rather than actually being involved in it.
Will Vorobyov was the founder of Transition Newcastle.
The idea of our separateness is very new. It's a very new experiment in the world. Healthy neighbourhoods where people know each other. People actually live longer, is what the research tells us. And they look out for each other, and we care for each other. So, again, at the heart of all is this is the notion that we need our communities because we need to care for each other, and that builds a much richer and a more satisfying kind of life.
Should governments be involved in this? Like, I mean, it looks as though it would be a good way to push policy if it has all these advantages to people. Do you have ambitions to get noticed by government, to get funded by government?
We'd love to be funded by government. They certainly were in the UK. And it has possibilities of pushing policy insofar as these are things governments should be picking up. But the movements often start with people, and then the politics tends to follow. So we're providing something that hopefully down the track will be actually incorporated as government policy, and the government will see that it's not just endless growth and the profit imperative that drives everything in government, but actually the people who live in the places.
I would love to sort of close off the ends and have a grass patch right down the middle where we could have fruit trees, we could have chicken coops, we could have just picnic areas where families can meet in the middle of the street and kids could play safely because the ends of the street are sort of gated off, and it would just be a community within itself. I mean,
yeah, that's a village you're talking about.
It is, isn't it? But I've always thought that would just be wonderful.
It's a catchy idea. Transition has spread to the US. It's mirrored in Europe by an emerging network of social streets. And a quick internet search will turn up transition streets and even towns in every state in Australia. There are now 11 transition streets in Newcastle and plans in the pipeline for many more. And a developing trend of curbside veggie gardens.
Yes, certainly people are planting veggies on the verges.
Do you find that you never know who your neighbours are until you organise something like this and people just come out of the woodwork?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you don't know what people's passions are and how interested they are in doing things together. It's been amazing. Here comes a neighbour already. Hello! Come over. What have you got, Michelle?
Annie Hastwell there. And the Newcastle Council is about to launch a search for 50 eco champions to take transitions even further into the streets of that town. I'm Sian Pryor. Thanks for your company today. Catch you next week. Up and down through the streets of your town.